Welcome to the Cordwainers In Their Shoes podcast. My name is Katie Greenier and I'm Creative Talent and Network Director at Pentland Brands. Cordwainers are shoemakers, and today the worshipful company of Cordwainers looks to promote footwear design and entrepreneurship in both education and the fashion industry. To celebrate the company's 750th anniversary, we've brought back our podcast for season two to explore what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who have made them. I'm in the studio with Alexandra Fullerton, a freelance stylist and writer, currently fashion director at large at Glamour UK. Previous to this, Alex was fashion director at Stylist Magazine. Over her 20-year career, Alex has contributed to Grazia and international editions of Vogue and Harper's Bazaar. Her commercial clients have included Stella McCartney, Amazon, and Marks & Spencers. She has worked with photographers including David Bailey, Victor Demarchier, Mary McCartney, Ranking, Ella Vonnenworth, and I regularly hear her contributing on BBC's Radio 4's Women's Hour and You and Yours. Alex's first book, How to Dress, was published by Pavilion in June 2018 and became the bestseller in Amazon's fashion category. Alex has been known to declare that she prefers shoes to some people and founded the hashtag The Daily Shoe to document her favourites on Instagram at Alexandra Fullerton. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Katie. Thank you for that introduction.
Oh, that's all right. It's a bit nerve-wracking, isn't it, being in the studio?
It's very professional. It's very slick in here.
So tell me, where did you grow up?
All over the place. I was born in Essex and lived there for a large proportion of my early years. Bit of a stint in Gloucestershire and Bristol, and then kind of Suffolk, and then going back to Essex.
Oh my God, you have literally done the southern part of the UK.
East-west.
Have you got a preference?
Essex. Yes. I've got an Essex on my passport, and I am an Essex girl.
Yay.
Through and through.
Just to clarify, I'm an Essex girl too.
We're the best. Essex girls. I also love, because I'm not obvious, you're not sat there in a pair of white stilettos and neither am I. So I say that I'm an undercover Essex girl because, well, I quite like the surprise element of, yeah, you're from Essex.
Well, I used to be the Essex girl on Big Breakfast with Wayne Hemingway and I had to wear white stillies. Funnily, I can't find any footage of that. Anyway, summarise your early fashion memories.
And my first fashion memory, I think I was about six, maybe five. And there weren't any clean white knickers in the laundry. My mother had bought a pack and the only available clean ones were mint knickers. Which
mint.
I was disgusted by. And I was so disgusted, I ripped them apart with my bare hands. My mother was livid. I wanted what I wanted to wear. Even if it was like underwear, it was part of the look. And mint was not that day's look.
Wow.
That's my earliest fashion memory.
That's exciting, isn't it? You started young with knickers. I love that.
I made a pair of shoes when I was 14 for a school art project. So even then, it was sort of shoes as opposed to like textiles or making a dress or sewing. I wanted to create a shoe.
So I'm intrigued. What did you make these shoes out of?
Carpet tiles. Yeah. So they were sort of a slightly Japanese Chopin style.
Yeah.
And they were carpet tiles stuck together, which I then drew around my foot on the top. Mr. Bowden in the DT room cut round them with a special cutty thing to create the base. And then I made sewed bits to tie them onto my foot, painted the sides, tie-dye or batiked the fabric that tied them round, wrote my name on them in Japanese letters on the inside.
Do you still have them now?
I don't know where the shoes are, but I have a photo. They were lime green and lilac with a sort of a bluey silvery element as well.
That is a wonderful early memory, a fashion moment. Did you actually ever wear them out?
They were very heavy and I couldn't flex my foot in them. So, and I didn't, age 13 or 14, I didn't have many places to wear them out. So they were posed in only.
I love that. So what was your ambition at school then? Was it, were you creative? I mean, you sound like you're amazingly creative.
I had a few moments where I thought I'd like to be a vet, like for like a week. That didn't happen. And I always wanted to do something creative. Fashion was sort of really, I just love clothes and putting together and telling stories with clothes. But until I started reading magazines, and Vogue in particular, that had a job of fashion editor, I thought that fashion was out of bounds to me because I didn't know how to sew, or like textiles classes had me cowering in the back in tears because I was sticking the bobbin in, I didn't know. And I thought that you had to sew to be a designer. Then I realised that you could put outfits together as a stylist. I did some work experience in PR and then started on magazines. So it kind of flowed that way. Creative fashion, foiled as a designer, styling was my
I think the thing route. Is, going back to school, it's you're not taught the breadth of careers. And I think that is so wrong. And even now, you think, how many years ago was that? If young people knew the breadth of careers, then actually it wouldn't be so hard to get into, or, you know, the roots would be more, you could see the roots. I think that's what's so sad sometimes about the way young people are taught. So you love Vogue, and when did you discover your, I suppose, art at writing and styling? How did that come about?
I went to the London College of Fashion to study fashion promotion. And at the same time, I had people have a day job. I had a night job, and I was writing for Melody Maker and reviewing gigs. So two or three nights a week after college or whatever, I would go and I had a big yellow A4 size notebook that I used to go and write down my notes at gigs in Camden as a young girl. That's a whole other story. But so I could write, and I knew that I could write.
And did you do English at sixth form or?
Yeah, I did the combined English, which was English language and English literature. I got a double B in that. But my English teacher always used to turn me off for writing in journalese rather than.
What's journalese?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's sort of a slightly more colloquial journalistic style of writing, a little bit more conversational, whereas the accepted tone should have been more academic and clearer. But
does she know what you do now?
No, I don't know what she.
Do you know what I mean? How wrong was she?
She was a very nice lady, and I do feel a bit bad. She wasn't very good at sort of rounding the class up, and she was very sweet and mild mannered. But yeah, I just always remember she was like, "Don't write in journalese."
So how did you get the Melody Maker gig?
Well, I was always very impatient. Oh, I still am. And while I was at university, I thought, I want to be working on a magazine. So I applied for a job as their staff writer and didn't hear back anything for literally 6 months. And I was like, well, obviously I haven't got this. But then their reviews editor contacted me and said, would I like to write for them to do reviews? I was like, yes, please, I would. And when you're like, how old was I then? 18 or 19? And like, loved like indie bands and thought like music was so cool. So that's a dream job. Isn't it?
Was that in an actual letter when they wrote to you, or was it a phone call? Because did we have email?
It might have been. No, I used to. What I used to do. So I think I got a letter. They might have put an email or address, which I then replied to, because I remember going upstairs into my dad's study and using his computer to write emails. And I would go, because Melody Maker was a weekly magazine, I think they went to print on Thursday. So every gig that I would go to, I would then write up. So I lived in Essex at the time. Obviously, all the gigs were in London. I'd spend my day in London, go to the gig with my notes. On my 1 hour train journey home, I would try to write it up longhand, like BlackBerrys didn't exist then, or even an iPhone. And then I would get home, type it up on my dad's computer and email it over to him at maybe like 1 or 2 in the morning, and then it would go to print.
So almost you were made for journalism because you were able to work the shifts that it takes to actually get the deadline done.
I think there's very much an expectation that you do whatever it takes to get any sort of creative job done, whether that is missing your tea or working late or working into the next morning or having a... There's also a misconception that the creative industries, you know, nobody starts until the afternoon. Everybody has a lie-in. That's absolutely wrong. It's a lie. And I blame Diana Vreeland for that myth because she never used to start work until 12 o'clock. So thanks for that, DV. But yeah, you do whatever it takes, if you care about it.
So you continued to study at London College of Fashion and you had the Melody Maker job.
Mm-hmm.
What happened then?
So I did continue to study at LCF, but there was a kind of a term or a module of doing work experience. I went off to do work experience. I had a great time as an Arena magazine. And all these magazines I'm mentioning have closed down now, which is heartbreaking.
I loved Arena. You just brought it back to me.
And I had the best time there. So my 1 month placement turned into 3 months over the entire summer holidays. Then they asked me to go back in once a week on Fridays. Then I started assisting their contributing editors and then other freelance stylists. I had my evening job and my day job. And then I think Melody Maker closed in maybe 2000 or 2001. So I wasn't there very long at all. But my day job of styling, being a fashion assistant, was keeping me busy. And then I thought, okay, well, sod this, I'm not going back to college because they're telling me what I need to do on fashion shoots and learning, but I'm actually doing that already. So that's my impulsive, impatient nature coming through. And I kept my course, my place open if I wanted to go back within a few years, but it just continued on. And maybe within 6 months, I had my first proper job at Glamour.
Wow. That is incredible, isn't it?
And now,
do you look back and go, how incredible? Did you know it was incredible at the time?
I felt that.
Or did you just work hard?
I worked very hard, but I also felt that a lot of lucky things had happened to me. Or, well, Albert Elbaz always used to say, luck can get you to the door, but what you do in the room is up to you. So, yes, there were lucky moments of synchronicity and serendipity, but if I hadn't have worked hard and loved it and wanted to do more, then I probably would have just, it could have just all fizzled away. So you have to keep up the momentum in a career, I think.
So you learn on the job styling.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? Because I think styling's one of those things, as someone that works with stylists, that actually is more a you do it. It's a thing that you do. I don't think people can teach you how to be a stylist. You can't. I don't think it can be taught. Is that true? How did it come about?
Well, that's something I'm considering often because now I lecture on Condé Nast College's MA in styling. So there's two sides of it. It is very instinctive. You either have taste or you don't. But with the MA, it's a lot about looking deeper than just putting together a nice outfit, because there are people out there who aren't stylists, always look put together and put together great looks, but don't know the fashion history or the significance of items or hidden messages and semiotics in the clothes. So I think that you either have it or you don't. You can then build on that to become next level and great at what you do, or you could just maybe segue into sort of personal shopping and choosing nice things that look good on people. It's one, half a dozen of one and six of the other. You need to have it.
Because it's not, I suppose the thing is, it's not one of those things where you, it's not like an Excel spreadsheet, is it? Where you're going to get the end equation and it's going to be right. You almost need to know what the consumer is or who it's going to, or, and then almost create magic within that.
It's very alchemical.
Yeah.
Alchemical?
Yeah.
It's very alchemical in the way that people work together on shoots. But I think that when I'm teaching students in styling, they have to think about critical theory and they have to think about relationships. And it's a little bit of psychology. How do you get the photographer to take the shot to include the shoes? Because photographers will often do like, yeah, let's do a beauty crop. And you're like, get the shoes in. I am anyway.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't shout at them to get them to do that. But that psychology of getting that in, knowing how to analyse trends, knowing how to work with brands, knowing what brands you should align yourself with. So it's critical thinking, but taste can't be taught, but you have to have taste to get to the next level.
You learnt all of that on the job.
Yes.
Who has been your, I suppose, biggest influence or teacher on this journey?
I think learning on the job as a stylist is all about the little nuances of starting out as an assistant, getting to know the way that your boss might tilt their head and you're like, I can see what they're looking at. Oh, they're looking at that. They're going to ask me for a safety pin in about 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and you've got it ready for them. And as you work with anybody closely, you can tell the signs that they're hangry or they're going through issues with the photographer or they're cross about certain things that you need to sort of smooth out and help out. But throughout my career, again, it's been like an intertwining and interweaving of things. And another sort of weird, it's not that weird because it makes sense. We're all in the industry together. But when I was at Glamour the first time around, which was maybe 2001 to 2003, I was fashion coordinator and then fashion assistant. The then entertainment editor was Deborah Joseph. We sort of went our separate ways for a while. She brought me back when she was editor of a bridal magazine as their fashion editor 5 or 6 years later, went our separate ways again. And she went back to Glamour to relaunch it as Digital First in 2017 and brought me back to be their fashion director at large. So even though we're not in the fashion department together, she's sort of a supporter and a champion, and our paths have sort of intertwined. So relationships and building relationships are like beyond key. And it's so weird. And we were saying that both of us went back to Glamour 16 years after we had left in a totally different variation. And I was doing exactly what I want, like 16 years, well, more than 16 years ago now, because I've been there 4 years. I was their fashion assistant and I was like, oh, I want to be shooting the covers and shooting the main fashion. And now that's what I was doing. So weird, but just normal when you're going in a career.
I think it's lovely when the universe provides and it seems that you work really hard. And I think that's the part, isn't it? And you've created your own luck by just working damn hard. Have you a preference to writing, styling or commentating?
I have been thinking a lot about this question. So being on set on a studio, so I was shooting Monday and Tuesday this week, or on Wednesday, so 2 days this week. Being on set in a studio is my happy place. I like buzzing with the team, talking to makeup, talking to a photographer, watching an outfit come alive on a model or a talent. I love that. As I've gone through my career, I've been doing more writing. And when I wrote my book, that was all about the tips that I'd learned from being a stylist. So I need both. Writing is very insular. When I'm writing, I'm at home on my own often. I may interview somebody but it's something that I do on my own. I can't even have the radio on or any music. It has to be deathly silent because otherwise I feel I can't concentrate. And yeah, styling is the fun, joyful thing that is maybe 10% of the job. Writing is the bigger part of the job. Isn't so fun, but doesn't require as much prep. There may be quotes to get, interviews to do, conversations to be had, but what goes into a shoot for maybe 10 minutes in front of the camera is kind of like weeks of planning. That hasn't answered your question. Commentating doesn't even come into it because that's not, I love having a chat, like I'm like in my element, having a conversation about shoes and stuff, but that's not my career. That doesn't pay the bills. It's writing and styling.
And do you ever get a point where you can't write, that you do the writer's block thing, or not really, you just go and have a cup of tea? Or
after I had written 9 chapters of my book, and maybe that was like 35,000 words, I was like, what? I have nothing more to say. Like, what can I say about this? And I remember I had quite a tight deadline, maybe a couple of months, and I had to write 40,000 words. And this last chapter was stumping me. And I had a few days and it was sort of, was it the end of September that I was doing it? It was after the shows and I was just lolling around in we called it the nook. It was like the breakfast nook and there was a sort of a seating area and I was just lying there going, I don't know what to do. And I had 2 days of writer's block and then I was like, oh, like, you're so close, snap out of it, get on with it. And I went and finished it off.
Do you think it was just the fear of finishing it off?
Maybe deep down psychologically, but... No, I honestly think it's I had nothing at that point.
Tired,
I hadn't
maybe.
Got my brain to think of what to say. Sometimes I procrastinate over writing, whereas I will get very into prepping a shoot and I'll be like, oh, I'll start that tomorrow. And it's the planning and then the process of it is much more easy.
So what inspired you to write your book?
I had no plans to write a book whatsoever, but a publisher contacted me and said, would you like to write a book? And I was like, oh, I don't know. She had some ideas for potential titles, which I was like, well, yeah, yeah. And she was like, what do you want to write about? So they say, write about what you know. And I was like, well, I know how to be a stylist, how to dress, how to put outfits together. So she loved that idea and it went from there.
How exciting. What did you do when you put down the phone after she called you?
I didn't do anything for a little while because at the time I was at a magazine that felt that if I was writing a book, that would be a conflict of interest.
Right,
so
okay.
I initially turned down the book deal.
Right, so you had to remain calm.
Yeah, and then until I thought for a little bit longer and then thought, oh, like this is too good an opportunity to miss. So I handed in my notice and then started writing the book once I left. That's why I had a shorter time frame because I'd been working a 3-month notice period before I could get stuck in.
And what was your process for that? Did you...
In writing the book?
Yeah, did you have... So you had loads of tips and loads of things that you'd learned from... How did you start it? Did you just section them all off? Like,
so I started writing the book by putting it into general chapters and then breaking that down into sort of almost like mini features that I would have written in a magazine about certain elements. So essential shoes to own, or what is the high-low mix, or what is the third piece, how to shop the sales. So broke it down chapter by chapter, section by section. And so I was quite methodical. Then divided up how many words that I had to write by the amount of chapters, so knew what I had to aim for per chapter, so knew that each mini section would be X amount of words. So weirdly, I did it quite analytically.
So let's go back to shoes quickly, or let's talk about shoes quickly. You have declared that you prefer shoes to some people and founded the hashtag The Daily Shoe. How did that start?
Katie Jane Hughes is a makeup artist and I used to work with her quite a lot. And she had started something called The Daily Face where she documented her makeup every day. And she was like, why don't you do that with shoes? Because you're like crazy for shoes. And I was like, oh, yes. So this is totally her credit. And I would put a pair of shoes on Instagram every day, whatever I was wearing. Then it kind of segued again into other shoes that I had seen on set, on shoots, at press days, but often they weren't on feet and I felt it was more engaging to see them as something that I was wearing. So I went through a phase again of kind of choosing things that were in stores that were available right now and that people could buy. So that's how the hashtag started.
And do you have a favourite pair of shoes?
I have one child because I have a favourite daughter. I have many pairs of shoes and I couldn't even... I mean, there are I could probably do a top five, but one is impossible.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same. I've got quite a few shoes and they all serve a role for a different day.
The thing is with shoes that they are all so different. So what might be your favourite ankle boot could not be your favourite sandal. Yeah. You know, it's not, you have to break it down.
They serve different purposes for different days and different looks.
Exactly.
And different feelings.
Yeah.
How you feel. And also, if you've got to be fast or slow.
Different practicalities. Yeah. Shoes get the most battering, don't they?
Yes. Sometimes I feel like I want to wear a pair of shoes. You know, and they're looking at me and they'll go so lovely with my outfit. But then I'm like, oh, the practicality of them. Can I be bothered to put them in my handbag and change out? And so that's a dilemma that I have quite often.
Daily.
Yeah, daily dilemma. You have consistently used your power for good in promoting sustainability and upcycling. How has this been received in your roles?
I think at this point in my career, I feel that I really need to atone for the sins of the fashion industry that has been building this appalling situation we're in as a civilization on the planet. So I need to do everything that I can to educate people, give people the knowledge that I've got about why certain dyes are not good, why the difference between organic cotton and normal cotton and linen or Ecovera. So I just need to make everybody aware of what we can do and just think about living just a little bit more kindly and definitely more sustainably. And Glamour has been phenomenal at this. We're very lucky. We've got a very switched on Gen Z and millennial audience who are very open and want to know all about sustainability. You know, that generation, sorry for the mess that we've left. I'm sorry for the mess that my generation's left it in, but we need to give people the tools to sort it out, as well as us sorting it out as well. But they're people who really care. So they've been very receptive when I've suggested ways to cover sustainability, ways to kind of not engage with greenwashing, ways to push brands that are more considerate and considered. So that is a privilege, say, out of other magazines. I don't know. Obviously, Glamour is where I'm at right now, but I don't know what other whether other magazines or other editors, you know, would feel the same. Deborah is so open to it, which is a joy.
Well, I think we've got to do it, and it's got to happen. I think I love stuff, and I always feel guilty that I love stuff, but I'm really lucky that I absolutely love other people's stuff. So I did a talk the other day, and it was all about how I love stuff, but how I actually offset that because of just loving a charity purchase and a charity find. And I get absolute joy from shopping charity shops and jumble sales because I feel like that's my happy place. And I don't think that I think I'm at my happiest when I've been to my favourite charity shop in St Margaret's, which is miles from where I live, but always something really good there. So I shouldn't have said that because actually people will be going to St Margaret's now.
Mentally noting down, like, how can I go to St Margaret's?
So what has been your best charity purchase?
I think the best thing I ever found in a charity shop was a gold brocade dress. It was very sort of 60s, actually maybe it was more 70s, because it was a bit Abigail's Party, a bit Margot Ledbetter, high-necked Empire line, and then very long down to the floor. And I got my mum to cut it into a mini dress for me. And I feel that what you find in charity shops, old true vintage, has been eclipsed by all the fast fashion that people are donating. It's amazing they're donating it, and it's being circular and cyclical. But finding a true vintage treasure, oh, it's like caffeine hit, dopamine, all of the joys rolled into one, isn't it? The thrill of the hunt.
So where do you normally shop?
Well, it's funny you should ask me that, because the 2 days I spent shooting this week, I was working with Barnardo's.
Amazing.
Working on a very exciting campaign, which is coming out in July. And I was rummaging in the basement of their Brixton store, pulling out all sorts of treasures to style up. 20 influencers, celebrities, actors, talent, singers in the creme de la creme of charity shop finds. So I was very happy when I saw that question. I was like, literally, I've just been like charity shopping for the past week.
So did you come back with whole bags of stuff for yourself?
I didn't. I was very restrained. And I think that what I do with my wardrobe, I once went to see an intuitive, and she was telling me that, oh, you're constantly doing different looks. You're doing this, you're doing the sparkly look, then you're doing that. And I'm like, no, I'm not. And then I twigged and I was like, well, in my job, I'm styling people in different looks every day. The minimalist, the eclectic, the da-da-da, the 60s, the whatever, the 50s, retro, blah, 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 the vixen. So I think she got mixed up between what I do in my job and my personal style. So, yeah, I was restrained in the charity shop.
So what is an intuitive?
A psychic. But she called herself an intuitive rather than a psychic.
I'm like, I need one of them.
Oh, she was amazing. There were other things, but nobody wants to hear about those in the podcast on shoes.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm really sure.
So, next. Who is the coolest sustainable brand we should support?
Instead of picking a brand, shop your own wardrobe. Wear your own clothes 30 times. Repair them. Use them. There are amazing sustainable brands. If you need something new, think about that first. But everybody I know will have hundreds of things in their wardrobe, things still left with tags on. Tailor them, change them, restyle them, rewear them. Wear that first. So you are your own most sustainable brand.
I also quite like swapping with my friends. You know, if they're bored of that outfit, I'll swap one of mine. And that works really well as well. Also, I swap my shoes a lot too. Have you shopped at Depop? Have you eBay? Do you eBay? Do you Vestiaire? Do you do that online secondhand or hiring? I suppose, outfits, looks?
I've hired quite a lot of stuff when I'm shooting. It is restrictive because sometimes you'll see the perfect dress, but it's not in the size of the person you're shooting. I've never hired for myself because I have a vast enough wardrobe already. And I have also, I haven't shopped on eBay or sold on eBay for years, likewise Vestiaire. But at the moment, I depop and repop and buy and sell quite a lot of stuff. And it is a joy. It's quite addictive having a clear out. Again, you get that dopamine hit, but you also get the thrill of the chase. And there are charity shops that have shops on eBay and Depop. So you can kind of get the rummaging without the physical rummaging. There might be somewhere in like Tunbridge Wells that's got great stuff. And if you can't get there, you can look at it online and see what they're doing. Likewise, you might have missed something from a store, so you can set up a search for it. And then maybe there's somebody out there who's got rid of their whatever it is that you can swoop. And if it's luck, if it's meant to be, it'll be in your size and you can do it.
Alex, I'm all over this because this is like my dream evening, is actually just flicking through Depop and Vestiaire. And actually, normally I have something in mind, but during COVID, I did loads of selling on it as well. So I actually, all the things that I thought, do you know what, I'm not going to wear that again, or it's too big or too small, or just didn't like it anymore, I sold online platforms and then bought something else from that online platform. So I am that person that gets that dopamine from the thrill of the chase and the, oh my God, I love it. And I hate it if I lose out, you know, if I've lost out on a purchase.
Heartbreaking. The ones that got away. Exactly. So painful.
So why do you think you love shoes so much?
Do you know what? Like, people ask me this question. I've honestly got no idea. I don't know. When I started getting into fashion, I had a Saturday job and I love fashion. I remember seeing a few things in magazines, but there would be things like a Chloe t-shirt, or there were a pair of boots from Alberto Ferretti, but it was just things that I loved. And somehow I would always find myself in the shoe department and just loved them. I think shoes are the mass fetish. Everybody's like, oh, I love shoes. But there are so many people who do take it to the next level. Maybe I should have some therapy or some like hypno past life regression. There may be a reason there. But they're mini sculptures, they're works of art, they can transform your mood and your personality, they can make your outfit 10 times, 100 times better, depending on the shoes. I love them. I love them so much.
I think it's nice when you just look down and just see a really lovely pair of shoes on your feet and you just think, they make me happy. You know, I think it's just that looking down, because you can't actually see yourself unless you're in a mirror. Whereas with shoes, you look down and they're there. I think that's the reason for me.
Yeah, yeah.
What were the pivotal points of your career?
I've gone through my career and felt that there were several moments that were big breaks. When I first, getting my first work experience, getting my first job at Glamour, leaving Glamour and getting my first commission with a big photographer for the Russian edition of Glamour, doing my own main fashion shoot, joining Stylist magazine as their fashion director just after they'd launched, securing Joan Smalls as a cover star, like just as she'd been crowned Models.com's number one model of the year, going on amazing trips, going to shoot Charlie Howard in the Maldives. But I have to say, this week doing the shoot for Bernardo's, when I told my husband I'd got the job, he was like, oh, that's like your dream job, isn't it? I was like, this is actually my dream job, where I can put in all the talk that I'm doing about sustainability into a shoot. Probably equally, doing the first shoot for Glamour, which featured everything that was either upcycled, recycled, or a sustainably made fabric. And that was maybe in 2018, which was sort of quite early and was a bit of a game changer. So yeah, that was a really pivotal moment. So there have been high points, and hopefully there will be more to come. Oh yeah, writing a book. That's quite pivotal, isn't
that's
it?
That's quite a big one. You even forgot that. So pivotal. What has been your most challenging project?
The 7.5 years I spent at Stylist magazine were intense and very challenging. It was a weekly magazine. I was in charge of the fashion department, which at the start just consisted of myself and an intern, 3 days a week intern. So growing that, when I left there, we were a team, I think, of four or five, including me, and changing its perception within the industry as like a free weekly magazine to a really respected, important fashion player was hard work, physically hard work because I was in the office often at 7:30 in the morning. There was a lot of international travel, but also the most satisfying.
What advice would you give to someone starting out in their career?
If you're starting out now, you've got to work very hard. You've got to be grateful and humble for the opportunities that you get given, but don't confuse that with not knowing your worth. You need to know that if you're working hard and you're doing a damn good job, you should be rewarded for that. But you've got to realise that there is a lot of graft and it's a very crowded industry and loads of people want to be a stylist or indeed a writer or have it work on a magazine. So keep working hard and make connections and chat to people, but don't get ideas above your station. And I say that to myself even now. I don't know if that's my imposter syndrome creeping in, but, you know, we're there to do a job and no one's more important than anyone else. So don't be like above making tea. Like everybody should make tea for people. If you're going to get a cup of tea, offer other people to have tea. Help with suitcases.
Do you think there's some stylists that won't and don't now? They're past it.
What, making the tea?
Making the tea, packing the boxes.
I'm sure it because styling is a very physical thing and hard work, and maybe if you were an assistant for 10 or 12 years and you were lugging the suitcases and packing them, you may feel you've done your time, and I get that as well, but there's a way of taking the karmic rewards for working like bananas for a decade but still being helpful and being considerate. So if it's the you like, honestly, it's whoever's career is up to them, but I think mucking in makes it easier. What do they say? A problem halved, shared is a problem halved. So both pack the cases and it's done half as quick.
Teamwork is dream work.
Teamwork makes the dream work, yeah.
So you now have a side hustle as a ghostwriter. Tell me about that.
Once I'd written my book, my publisher got in touch with me and said, oh, I wonder if you might like to write a book for somebody else. It's like, what do you mean? And not having come from an author's background or a writer's background, I sort of knew that like big celebs didn't write their own books and sit there and type it all out. So my wonderful publisher, Steph, has put me forward for ghostwriting jobs, which I've got, that she has been publishing and commissioning, put me in touch with the authors and I've ghostwritten them. It's a whole other world. It's quite intense because you're writing somebody's voice. So you have to be really aware of getting the nuances of their tone of voice, especially if there's somebody that's on the TV that people will recognise and be like, well, that doesn't sound like them. But I enjoy that deep dive challenge. And you can often, if I'll interview somebody, you'll send over a list. You have to send over a list of questions before and they get bounced back from the PR or whoever, the manager. But if you're ghosting, then you can ask all of those questions. And just being quite nosy, I quite like to get deep dive, get down and find out all the reasons.
So who or what inspires you?
Ooh, inspiration is everywhere. It's like a song on the radio. It's a sunny day. It's like a walk in the countryside. It's looking at a picture or a bit of art. It's a bit of sculpture. Or it's, I don't know, my daughter putting on weird, clashy socks. Or like, if you are sort of visual or creative, it's everywhere. It's sort of synesthesia. It's coming at you from all angles. And that's the fun part, because you could see somebody on the bus and there's an old lady and she's like got her leopard print shopper and her leopard print headscarf. And then you're like, oh, wouldn't that be a good idea for a story? And going to places. So I went to a theme park for my daughter's friend's birthday on the weekend. And I kept thinking that it would be incredible to do a shoot here. Out of hours, make it a bit creepy, make it have ball gowns in it or something that was totally incongruous to like the theme park setting.
You spoke about your daughter. Does she know what you do? And do you style her?
I'm not allowed to style my daughter. Well, she does like me to help her get dressed. So I'll show her options, but then she makes the final decision. And yes, she does know what I do and she does think it's fun and cool. She's always saying, oh, mummy, will you meet a fashion designer today? And will you tell them that I like making clothes and doing things? So she's 7 and does make scrunchies on my sewing machine and is quite into making clothes for her dolls and cutting up all my fabric stash. She's very good at crochet scarves. So, yeah, so if you were to ask her in 14 years' time, then she'd be like, oh, I want to be a fashion designer. And I was like 6 and 7 and making clothes for my dolls.
How fortunate is she, though, to have that kind of I suppose, strong-minded, career, beautiful, just a beautiful, inspirational mum, you know, because
I think that... Kate, you're going to make me cry.
But that is true, though, isn't it? Because having such an amazing career, having being on a journey and doing what you do is really hard. And I think it's one of the hardest careers, really, to crack into. I really do think it is. And I work in the same business as you, not as a stylist, but I always do think it's one of the hardest, because I think the beginning slog is so hard. You know, the beginning of your career, there is no formula. There is no, you know, Excel spreadsheet, or, you know, you will put this together and it will work. It is about your own taste, and there isn't a ruling for that. So you have to work doubly hard and impress the right people and network with the right people and be in the right places and know the right things. And the stars do need to align and the universe needs to provide. But that isn't just about luck. And I think to have a mother that has works in that career and does all the other side hustles that you do is incredible. And I'm sure I'll probably be seeing her in 14 years and we'll be talking about it.
I think it is, especially for girls, she needs to see that mummy has got a job that is fun, that I love, and that I work hard at. And if she finds that, she too can have that. And again, back to the school's career advice, that it's not just a set path. Like, nobody at school knew what I was talking about when I said I wanted to work on magazines. So yeah, giving her that inspiration. But equally, if she was really into sport or if she was really academic, as a parent, you do anything to support your children's desires. So I would be watching rugby every weekend morning if that's what she wanted to do.
Is there anything that you'd like me to ask you that I haven't asked you? Because otherwise we'll go into the quick fire round.
Quick fire.
Quick fire. Okay. Quick fire round. High heels or flats?
Flats.
Favourite food?
Lettuce. Iceberg. I eat a quarter of an iceberg lettuce, or maybe half an iceberg lettuce every single night. I adore it. I love it.
How are you coping with the lettuce shortage at the moment?
Do you know what? It was a serious condition. So I like iceberg lettuce. So I've then had to diversify to maybe a romaine or a little gem. Or if there aren't any lettuces, then I'll have a carrot. But iceberg lettuce.
And what do you have it with?
On its own. A chunk.
Just a chunk.
Oh, it's heaven. So crispy, so refreshing.
You need to live on a lettuce farm like me. The scariest thing you've ever done?
Yes, it was on Saturday when I went on the Wipeout roller coaster that I somehow volunteered to go on. I thought I was going to die.
I love that the scariest thing was only on Saturday.
up until, if we were doing this last week, I don't know what my answer would be.
Karaoke song?
Oh, Cameo's Word Up. I kill it. I'm a different person. I would be impressed.
Favourite cocktail?
I couldn't decide this. It's either maybe margarita in summer or an old-fashioned in winter.
Both good. Would you rather an extra arm or an extra eye?
I don't want either, thank you.
Neither. What's your favourite read?
I am nearly finished Consumed by Arja Barber, which is important. It should be required reading for everybody who wears clothes.
Sun holiday or activity holiday?
Just let me lie on a beach, please.
How long can you do that for?
A week.
Yeah, because you couldn't lay still for long. Best place you've ever visited?
The best places that I've ever visited for work, I'm going to narrow this down a bit, if I may, was a city to shoot in Hong Kong and then shooting in the Maldives. They were both like iconic opportunities for work.
Best travel tip?
Pack in outfits, always.
I pack in colour.
Two tops to every bottom. It's always also a really good idea.
What's your guilty pleasure?
Guilty pleasure is lying on the sofa on a Thursday, Friday and Saturday night and eating a whole bag of sharing crisps to myself with a glass of pink carver.
Sounds right. Tidy or messy?
An organised mess.
Do you enjoy building flat pack furniture?
No, thank you.
Most productive, morning or evening?
Morning, definitely.
Would you rather swim to work or cycle to work?
Walk to work? Yeah. I would rather walk to work because that's great. Thanks.
Do you think you'd make a good Prime Minister?
No, but I think there are many people who would be better.
That was brilliant. So for more information on Alexandra Fullerton, where should our listeners go?
I spend quite a lot of time on Instagram, which is at Alexandra Fullerton is my handle. and my website is alexandrafullerton.com.
Thank you so much, Alexandra. It's been an absolute pleasure to walk in your shoes. For more interest in cordwainers livery, please visit our website, cordwainers.org, or our Instagram, Worshipful Cordwainers. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And oh, what a lovely, lovely time. What a lovely place and lovely time I've had with you. And I literally can't wait to hear more off this thing.
We're going to talk for another hour now, Katie. I know this.
Yeah. Right. Bye.
Bye.